Okay, so today I'm in Lambourne with Dan and Claire Kubler. Thank you very much for letting me come to your magnificent new yard and talk to you today. So you've both got a joint license. Any particular reason why you decided to both be on there? Is it just the...
We both always wanted to be racehorse trainers. It just so happened we met and got married. If we'd never obviously got married, we'd have gone off on our own ways. And it's a shame that joint licences didn't exist to begin with, but well done to the BHA for listening. Dan actually campaigned on social media and they caught wind of it. And yeah, they made it happen, which is fantastic. It's just nice to share, you know, ultimately it is shared responsibility, shared decision making. You know, we're in it together like we are with the whole team. But it's nice now for others to be able to do it with friends or family. Yeah, it's opened up a lot more opportunities for people.
And we're at Sarson Farm. How long have you been at this yard in its current...
So we bought it a while back, but obviously it takes a while to get planning permission because it was a really run-down farmyard. We've knocked it down and got to build it from scratch. So we put a lot of thought into the whole design of it. We moved in officially pretty much about 5 years ago, 4 years ago.
Yeah. I think end of 2018, very end of 2018, we sent out our first runner from the yard. We literally moved the horses in about 2 weeks before. It still wasn't finished. It was only half built, but it was big enough to be operational from. First runner was a winner. And then we were sort of finishing it off, and then we had a lockdown, which slowed everything up to be complete. And then once we came out of that, then we kind of actually finished most of the work during that lockdown. And then since then, we've just been trying to, you know, we've been 100% focused on training horses instead of building somewhere for to train them, and obviously we built a lot of staff accommodation. You know, our team's really, it is a team effort. Everyone puts a lot of work in, and it's all about working together. And you know, we made sure that not only the horses had a really nice place to live, but also the staff.
Okay, we'll talk a bit more about the setup and the staffing and everything in a bit. But just want to talk a bit about your backgrounds, Claire. I read that you were Cambridge educated, got a degree. Specialised in physiology, but then became a forensic accountant. So how did that...
I was just very good at science at school, very logically minded, analytical. So ended up at Cambridge, did natural sciences, and you specialise as you go through your degree. So in the final year, I specialised in physiology. That's all about how the body works, which was fascinating. And I was very lucky. I got to joint publish a paper as well on muscle cells, which was a real challenge, and I loved it, but it certainly wasn't a career for me though. It's a bit too repetitive. So yeah, jumped into accounting. I wasn't really sure. I always wanted to be a racehorse trainer, but how to get there, I wanted to do a couple of other things to understand business and how to run your own place first. So a lot of my friends at university who were going into banking said, go for accounting. So I did auditing to begin with, but ended up moving into forensic accounting, which was really interesting, very varied, got to travel a lot, see lots of different companies, be involved in construction disputes. So yeah, it was constantly analysing everything that was going on. I loved it, but obviously horses is my real love. So I jumped ship, moved full time into racing. Spent a lot of time with the likes of John Warren, working with him at the sales, which was really interesting, seeing what they look for in talented horses, and travelling the world as well, getting to be assistant to people in California and Jeremy Cedar and Newmarket.
And you've travelled, you were at, you got a degree at the Royal Agricultural College, and then you did your fair bit of travelling as well before you both gravitated to Lambourne.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit of a gypsy when I was younger. I sort of left school and I wasn't 100% sure what to do with my life. I've always been a very competitive person, loved sport. And I went down to Australia and I ended up working with horses. I'd ridden a bit as a kid, and that really sort of ignited something in me that I really wanted to spend my time. I loved the challenge of that. This wasn't racehorses, but just it was working a lot with young horses and developing them and understanding them and working working with them, and it's just such a, it's a very special thing when you work with a horse and you teach it new things, and that partnership that you form together with the horse and developing it and coming along. And the person I was working for, he said to me, he'd trained a bit when he was younger, and he'd said, like, you know, the only real sort of profession within the horse world where you can basically start with not very much and actually make something out of yourself is in horse racing. So I came back here, did the training at the Northern Racing College, as it was then, did that, went and worked in a yard, and then thought, well, I need to get some, you know, more in-depth education, understand how to run businesses and understand the science behind the horse, really. So I did a degree at Cirencester, which was brilliant. It, you know, it gave me the foundational knowledge of businesses and equine science and things. And also I could spend a lot of time riding out for local trainers and, you know, still working with horses every day. So I was able to pay my way through university by riding out, which was helpful. And then I went and worked for various different trainers all over the world. And, you know, just always with this passion to train. And I think the, you know, once I kind of understood what a racehorse trainer was properly, you know, having looked into a bit, and I read Martin Pipe's autobiography, and I was just hooked, and I was like, this is brilliant. Like, you know, there's so much to it, and working with horses is fantastic, but also the competitiveness and solving each little puzzle, analysing the horse, understanding it, how do we get this horse to perform to its best? And yeah, it's just, you know, I've been very lucky. I've worked for some really good people, and I've learned a lot of things, and at some point you sort of think, you know, I'd like to be the one making the final decision. So yeah, eventually Claire and I decided that we'd go out and do it on our own.
Were horses a part of your childhood?
Only a little bit, really. So my family originally is from Switzerland, and we used to go there in the summers, you know, and that they're sort of originally family farms, and we'd go and mess around with the horses there. And so I always loved it, but, you know, where I grew up in, you know, my parents don't have anything to do with horses, but it was something I always wanted to do. So when I finished school and I wasn't quite sure what to do, and I did a few odd jobs to save a load of money and went to Australia, and I sort of fell into it a little bit. But that opportunity to start working with horses, then that was me away, you know, like.
Okay, and Claire, you were steeped in horses. There's a joke. Your parents' stud farm bred reverence.
Yeah, I was really lucky. Mum and Dad, they got into it as a hobby, and the first horse they leased, and he was a jumper and won 15 races. So I think as a family, we were all hooked after that, but they went more into the flat. And yeah, growing up, I was always surrounded by them, looking after them, rehabilitating any ones that have come home, and breaking them in, getting them first ridden. So yeah, it was kind of definitely in my blood.
So what was it always the end? Was always the end game, even though you did do all the academic stuff?
Yeah, I think during when I was less than 10, I wanted to be a jump jockey, and I soon realised I didn't have the nerves to be a jump jockey. So after that, yeah, since 12 years old, pretty much, I remember going, I want to be a racehorse trainer. So it was how to get to that point. Yeah.
And so you've built this yard from scratch. I'm told that you got a special somebody in to design it. I mean, what was, yeah, where did you get the, you know, what specifications did you sort of come up with, and where did you get them from?
Over the years working for other people, you always pick up lots of good ideas as to how you do things. You see facilities that you'd want to copy. Looking after flat horses, a lot of them are so young, and it's just like children, you know, they'll pick up a bug so easily. So one of the most important things that we have to overcome is keeping them healthy. So that was a big part of our design process, was looking into the airflow. Part of the yard is actually built into a hillside, so it's really important that that was designed to allow top airflow, and also just for the horse's welfare in terms of having lots to look at, you know. And some of them have got half and half partitions so they can have a friend. Lovely big stables, lighting. Dan did a lot of research into that. There's actually research from Japan, isn't there, about how actual lighting can help the horse grow faster and stronger. So it's always looking for different ideas, whether it's from past experiences, So Alan Crichton, he did all the airflow calculations for us, or even just research that's out there in Australia, Japan. They're very forward thinking.
So would you sort of class this as state of the art at the moment?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's phenomenal. We're very lucky to have been able to do what we did. My family are construction by background. So obviously we were tapped into their knowledge. My brother came down to help for a week and a half. He stayed here for like a year and a half and he lives in the Lake District. So we were incredibly lucky to have that knowledge and support. You know, he's a civil engineer. He got behind all the machines, dug all the trenches, but knew all the terminology. You know, as racehorse trainers, we know racing terminology. We don't know building control terminology. So we got up to speed, really good challenge. Glad we did it. We were a bit naive on day one. But yeah, it's been a really good result, and it's now starting to reap the rewards of having a facility of this standard.
And I'm told that you put as much emphasis on that a good and happy team of people working for you as you do the horses. You only sort of, I assume everybody would do that, or would you go that extra yard?
I think, look, really simply, it's a bit cheesy, but if you've got happy people, you've got happy horses. And the whole thing, I think, within you know, all businesses, how you look after the people who, you know, you work with every day is really important, and how that all works is something that maybe historically racing has had a bit of catching up to do in places. And certainly, you know, there's still things where it's quite different to a lot of other industries. But, you know, if you've got happy people around you and you've got people who are fulfilled by doing their work and their job, you know, that reflects into the horses. And, you know, it's not always easy, but, you know, I think I'm a sort of natural researcher. I always want to find out about things, and that sort of plays out in the science that we've been talking about and the sort of, you know, designs for the horses. But also, you know, how can we create a really enthusiastic team, and how do we constantly keep upskilling the team and developing them? You know, the better your riders are, that can only help your horses. You know, all those things. I suppose it's the sort of Dave Brailsford, you know, the British cycling team sort of thing of marginal gains. Every little thing you can do helps, you know, the results on the track.
And that's one of the things that you insist on, top quality work riders?
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, ultimately, if you come in young and enthusiastic, we've got exceptional work riders that can coach people to bring them into, you know, into that high standard. I mean, we've got, now we're developing a real work rider development pathway, really, aren't we, with the training that they're getting and just seeing the improvement in those less experienced riders. It's phenomenal to watch, and people are so dedicated, especially when we work with racehorses. One, we're very fortunate to be doing that, and two, we're also competitive, like super competitive. Even anyone who's quiet. I think that's why you come into racing. Yeah, and everyone wants to do the best by the horses. So when you say this is a challenge, no, you could change this, or, you know, improve your core doing this exercise, they want to do it because they want to be better riders. They want to get the best for their horse that they look after so that it can achieve its best on the track. And yeah, and they're the team that are on the ground. You know, they know what's going on. They come to us. You know, it's real. We want it to be an open door policy. You know, we try and have team meetings and make it an open forum for them to give us ideas and say, yeah, have you thought about this, or have you thought about that, or could we try this? And you get amazing ideas listening to your team.
Yeah, I think it's that working as a team and that feedback from the team about what can we do better. Some of the best ideas come from them. And it's, you know, it's not just riders, it's you know, we've got people who don't ride, but, you know, they're incredibly important. And, you know, everything from, you know, mucking out a stable, I mean, it sounds sort of quite basic, but, you know, that's where health starts. A clean stable is a healthy stable, and, you know, it's really important those people care a lot about their job. So, you know, bringing all of that together to get our team really you know, bought into getting the results on the track, and everyone matters and everyone's important. And, you know, all the little treatments they do on the horses, and, you know, the love and the care that hopefully reflects in the results.
So Sarsen's Farm is in Lambourne, which is known predominantly as the headquarter of jump racing. Was it a conscious decision to be here and not Newmarket, which would be the logical, you'd have thought the logical place to be as a flat yard?
Well, we actually very first started down in Whitsbury, which is where Desert Orchid was trained, and David Ellsworth, and then Rafe Beckett had all that success. And we started in a very small yard there and sort of outgrew it after a couple of years. And it was really at looking where was the opportunity to go next. And the Jockey Club had bought the Lambourne Gallops probably 3 or 4 years before that. And they'd really invested a lot to bring the standard up to similar to what they have in Newmarket, and they offer a Newmarket. So, and it just happened that there was a yard that was the right size for us to rent to take that next step from where we were. And so we went there. I wouldn't say it was a yard that totally worked for us, but the plus was we were riding past this every day, and that was still in the days when Claire and I used to ride out a lot, and I used to forever be saying, oh, we should really look at that, we should really look at that. And then eventually it sort of became like, okay, well, you know, we're paying rent, actually. We'd be better off paying a mortgage.
So what was it sitting there empty all that time?
Yeah, it was a sort of derelict farmyard, basically. The Jockey Club were actually using it at the time to store tractors and things like that. And it, I mean, I'll show you the picture afterwards, but, you know, the whole thing was just collapsed buildings, and, you know, there was a lot of asbestos sheds that needed removing and things like that.
But. Okay, now you've mentioned the word science already. Would it be fair to say you're a science and data-driven yard? Well, I've been told that you are, but I'm hoping you confirm that.
We're both very analytical people. I think coming into racing, having had a very scientific background, and hearing other sports, you know, in terms of the data they're using, it is surprising, or was surprising particularly then, that the use of data and information was kind of slightly shunned in racing. It wasn't attractive, and to us that seemed to be a real edge to push hard into. Mm. Naturally, we enjoy it anyway. The amount of information you get is incredible, and you're always learning. And I think we both love that challenge of coming across new ideas and going, oh, wow, you know, when you suddenly, it's just pieces of a puzzle and equation, and going, actually, when you suddenly add that into that equation, it all suddenly makes sense. It's very rewarding and satisfying. You know, we've had some really good luck with some older horses that have come to us, and it's having all those pieces of scientific information and analysis of ourselves, understanding form, but also adding in the horsemanship of your team, adding in the facilities of Sarsen Farm. We've done really well, and horses, we've got a horse, Andalip. I mean, he arrived rated 65, and he's now in the 90s. He's won 8 races and over 100,000.
94, I'm told.
In less than 2 years, you know, and that's as an older horse. And yeah, it's satisfying to, you know, show that all those decisions and thought processes that you made were right. But you're always pushing. You always want more. You can't sit and think, oh yeah, I know everything. And that's what horse racing's great, because no one ever knows everything.
I've had my card marked with some of the things that you do, which are probably more unusual. Do you mind if I run through them and you can sort of explain if I've got, first of all, if my card's been marked properly, and then if, you know, what, just a little bit about each, is that okay?
We'll give it a go.
Right, sectional timing on the gallops.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I mean, it's fairly obvious, but, you know, it's understanding how fast your horses have gone, and you can, visually, you can see a lot, but, you know, our main work gallop, you can see the last 5 furlongs. So if they're working over 6 or 7, you can't really see it very well, and they're a long way out, away from you. And actually, by the time the horses get to you, if they've gone hard early and they come past you more steadily, and you can go back and look at those times, you then understand, okay, well, that's why that happened. Equally, if they fly past you like Frankel, but actually it turns out that they've walked along for the first 3 or 4 furlongs, well, you know, you can probably downgrade them a little bit. So it's understanding the horse you've got, because once you understand the horse you've got, you can plan a campaign for that horse to achieve the best results possible.
Okay, heart monitors and recovery time.
Yeah, it's really interesting looking at the recoveries. The monitors that we were using have been superseded by another company now that we have started with, and their data is incredibly accurate, and Yeah, I think over the years, you need the more data you have, the better you can analyse it and make informed decisions. And certainly getting horses like Astro King in the yard and just seeing his recovery time is just phenomenal to watch. You know, your average kind of recovery of a horse would be 1 minute 40, say, after a gallop, you know, a decent gallop. His is 45 seconds, you know, and that's just showing inside him. You know, when you're at the sales, all you can see is the outside of the horse. You can see its temperament a bit, but you see its biomechanics, how it moves. What you can't really understand is their heart. And by using equipment like this, you can start actually talent spotting at home and saying, wow, this horse's recovery is insane. And I think particularly when you're going over the more 10 furlong and upwards trips, if you've got an incredible heart, that's only going to be a huge advantage for them to get that aerobic system working.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you're measuring fitness, but there's also sort of calculations and things you can do that help you understand horses' ability as well. And that's, again, a very useful tool in understanding the talent and then how do you develop that horse as it goes through its career.
Can you measure it after an actual race? I mean, people say the horse blew for a bit. Can you sort of utilise it as well?
You could, but you'd have to go and sort of listen with a stethoscope and things like that. But, you know, hopefully going into the race, you know how fit your horse is and where it is, and you know, you'll have an idea of, you know, and there's no doubt, there's nothing like a race for really, you know, bringing a horse that last little bit forward. But you know, you can do it, you can get a horse very, very fit at home if you want to. It probably doesn't suit the, you know, the way we campaign horses a lot of the times, have them, you know, the first time they run every year, absolutely fit to the, you know, because people like a day out at the races and they like going racing. And if you've thrown everything out so that the first run of the season is the Derby, you know, is the absolute pinnacle of what that horse is going to achieve. You know, there's also, with fitness, you're always pushing right to the limit. And then has to be a recovery afterwards. So if you do that for the first run of the season, you know, where do you go next with it? And, you know, racing is, yes, it's about being competitive and winning, but it's also about giving owners, you know, days to enjoy and go and compete, and hopefully you can get it right so you can win your first race and you'll improve and go and win your second race and your third race.
I've written down young horses gene testing in fibres, and I've probably missed that. It sounds like a breakfast, doesn't it? But tell us about, have I got some of that right?
So there's genetic testing done over in Ireland. I think they do a whole range of different tests, but one that we have found to be incredibly useful, and it's about 80% accurate, is what they call the speed gene test. So you're really looking at your muscle fibre makeup in your racehorse. So how much fast twitch have you got versus slow twitch? And they've actually been able to plot now, looking at that fibre type balance, whether you're kind of more orientated to speed trips, middle distance, or staying. So it's been a useful tool, really, hasn't it? Particularly when you've been sent a horse that the previous connections kind of didn't quite know what trip to run the horse over. By doing that test, it can help you narrow it down and confidently go, yeah, I think this is right. So, for example, Astro King, when we bought him, his form over 10 furlongs hadn't really worked out. But actually, if you looked at the stride data and you actually said in the form, well, hold on a minute, you know, he lost a shoe that one day, he finished lame another day, he ran on soft ground another day, it makes you think, maybe it is worth trying 10 again. But by doing this genome test, he came back as what they call a CT. You get one gene from your mum and one from your dad, C's for the speed and T's for the slow twitch. He was a CT, which is kind of 10 to 12 furlongs. So it gave us confidence to say, yes, come on, let's give this another go. Let's go 10 furlongs. And actually, William Buick last year got off him and said, you could try 12 with him. So it's nice to have that up our sleeve, you know, to hopefully try at some point this year.
I've been nodding away when you've been saying slow twitch, but you're going to need to explain what that...
Yeah, so to explain, basically, there's, in the simplest terms, there's two different types of muscle fibres. There's slow twitch muscle fibres and fast twitch muscle fibres. So fast twitch muscle fibres are what give you the power to sprint and be fast, and slow twitch are more based for stamina, so, you know, so you can go a distance. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can have different proportions of those muscle fibres. And what these genes do is, if you've got what they call the CC genes. They're coding for fast twitch muscle fibers. So you have more fast twitch muscle fibers. Whereas if you have the TT genes, which are the ones that code for your slow twitch muscle fibers, so if you've got two of those genes, then you're going to have more slow twitch fibers. So you're going to be more suited to stamina type events. And then if you've got one of each, you're sort of somewhere in the middle and you're middle distance.
Am I assuming that this sort of information isn't something you can get from a horse that you're thinking about buying from the sales book?
You can. There are people who sort of go and pluck hair and sort of run it through a DNA analyzer at the sale. It's pretty expensive to do it. And, you know, you'd probably realistically need bigger budgets than what we're working with to make it worthwhile, if that makes sense. And really, to some extent, it doesn't matter. It's when you get the horse home and you want to work with that horse and how are we going to develop it. It's a piece of information that's really useful because, you know, we're just starting to do some quicker work with some of the two-year-olds. But if you understand that one of those two-year-olds is a TT, it's not really going to be suited, or, you know, there's always exceptions, but it's unlikely to that you're not going to see the best of that horse until it can run over a mile and a quarter, mile and a half next year. You're probably going to train it differently to one if that's looking like, you know, genetically should be a 5 or 6 furlong horse and is showing you those kind of signs. You know, and it's part of the puzzle because I'm sure you, one of your questions is going to be about looking at stride patterns.
The very next one.
Well, there you go. So should we go on to that?
But basically, it takes a lot of the guesswork out. So you save time by knowing or having a good idea. Yeah. Rather than having to try and find out what trial and error.
Whether you're betting or whether you're training horses, a lot of it is probabilities. There is no perfect exact science, and it's just getting those probabilities in your favour. So having more information like this, you know, yes, it might, you might be in the 20% where it actually doesn't work. It's not the right thing to work from, but if it's 80%, that's pretty high.
Okay, so as anticipated, stride length and stride cadence.
So it's, again, it's another piece of the puzzle. Now, stride length, obviously, if you're taking longer strides, you're probably moving faster unless it's taking you longer to take those strides. So, but what you find is that most decent horses have a fairly decent stride length, and there's sort of, you know, measurements that indicate if a horse can stride over this distance when it's going at a certain speed, it's probably got some ability, provided it can sustain that length of stride for long enough. And then the other bit is cadence or turnover. So that's the number of strides you take per second. So if you take lots of strides per second, you're very powerful, more likely to be a sprinter than if you take a stayer. And if you think about human runners as well, you can kind of visualize it. A stayer, you take those big, long, smooth strides, but you take less of them a second. So if our stride length is 7 meters and we're taking 2.2 strides per second, we're going to cover less ground than if we take 2.5 strides per second. But so the speed is higher when we're taking more strides. The payoff is that from an energy capacity side of things, obviously you're burning more energy to get that turnover. So there's a biomechanics called sort of optimum stride pattern for each horse, and that will vary from horse to horse. So the ones that with the high turnovers will be the faster sprinters, and the ones with the slower turnover will be our stayers.
Okay, you've built up a quite rightly a reputation for improving horses that have come from other yards. Astro King cost 38,000, and then won 206,000, including the Cambridgeshire. And you mentioned Anderleap, that was rated 65, and if my information is correct, is now rated 94. I'm assuming that horse had to have been a 94 or better horse when it was rated 64. You can't make a moderate horse a good horse, or can you? I mean, it's...
Yeah, and I think that comes back to the pedigrees and what the breeders are doing at home. We do a lot of pedigree analysis when we go to the sales, whether we're buying yearlings or older horses, because as you say, they have to have that raw ability within them. It's going back to my Cambridge days of physiology. You know, if the horse hasn't got the really strong heart, it's never going to be as good as the one that does. Has it got the right muscle makeup? Has it got, you know, good red blood cell capacity? Has it got a good pair of lungs? Or did it get a bit sick as a foal so it actually can't achieve what it could have done? So yeah, you need all that right, but then it's down to us then. When it comes into our yard as trainers, it's our responsibility to try and get that full potential out of them. And as Dan said before, that's a whole team effort. It's not just Dan and I analysing form, analysing all the bits that we could improve. It's down to the team really caring and going that extra mile, you know, doing more of the ice boots, doing more of, we do various different treatments, don't we, to try and help. But it's a day in, day out thing. And they have to be religious about it, and they do it because they love it, and they're competitive.
Carry on.
No, it's just, the pieces of work at home, you know, making sure each piece of gallop they do is high quality, that they're doing it to the right times. And one thing we haven't touched on yet is kind of the biobanding that we do, and that requires our team to really know clocks in their head when they're writing pieces of work. So that's very much what we used to do back in California days. But this is a lot more structured now around science and evidence to strengthen bone so that they can perform and have really long, good careers.
Yeah, can you talk about biobanding then, what we've mentioned it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest way probably to describe it is to say if you take a group of 13-year-old, let's say boys, and they all play cricket, you've got one who started shaving and you've got one who's still got a squeaky voice over in the corner, and they've got completely different physiques because they're at different points of development. So you've got your physical age. So with our 2-year-olds, you'd have the same thing. You've got a group of 2-year-olds and you'll have some who are the 13-year-old with a squeaky voice, and you've got some that are, you know, they're chasing after the girls and they're causing all kinds of trouble. And they've got very different physiques, and those bigger, stronger ones in sport generally an advantage. I use cricket because it's a good example. You know, a bigger, stronger, you know, your one who's more like a 15, 16-year-old can obviously hit the ball further, bowl quicker and all the rest of it, and it's an advantage and tends to be the one that gets selected for the, you know, the team and then gets extra coaching, and then they're the ones that, you know, progress into the county players and they go up through the system. The problem is that they've been totally dependent on their strength advantage to become successful. And when they enter the sort of adult game, because they've maybe got away with not having as good technique, they then fall apart. And also in the sort of talent development pathway, some of those young, you know, those less developed boys will have fallen out the system because they don't enjoy it. Nobody likes losing all the time. And so they go and find something else to do. And actually what they've started to do in cricket is put them more into the group that they would be based on their physiology rather than their actual age, so that, you know, the ones who stand out are the ones with good technique, and you're working on developing technique because that physical advantage is taken away. And it's something that's very common across a lot of sports. And the other thing is understanding, you know, our 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, particularly the 2-year-olds, they're still growing, they're still developing, and your body is going through a lot of changes. And there's times in that process where you're much more susceptible to injury. And we spent a fair bit of time talking to someone at the University of Bath who heads up one of their sports science departments that deals specifically with youth athletes. And, you know, they've developed programs with the football academies that have reduced the injury rates and the number of days lost training in those academies by 80%, which is huge. By understanding where these young athletes are in their physical development and training them to an appropriate level. And, you know, we very much, that's the principle we use when we're trying to train horses, because yes, everyone loves a fast early Ascot 2-year-old, but if you try and make a horse that isn't do that, you're more than likely going to cause injuries that cause issues for the rest of its training career. Our job as trainers is to fulfill, you know, you touched on it before, is each horse to fulfill its potential. And if we do so sometimes the patience is about, you know, okay, so we didn't go to Royal Ascot this year, but if we can go to Royal Ascot next year and every year after, because we've developed a really nice horse, the owners are going to have so much more fun with that than, you know, us calling up and saying, oh, things haven't quite worked out here, we've got a problem. And, you know, it's difficult enough that if we can work out where horses, you know, are at greater risk, to be a little bit more patient. Well, that's brilliant, you know.
Okay, now we've talked about all the things that you do differently to a lot of other trainers. Now, I do like figures. The last three seasons, 2021, 146 runners, 18 winners, 44 places, and 160,000 prize money. 2022, 176 runners, 26 winners, 51 place, 323,000 prize money. And 2023, 172 runners, 24 winners, 69 place, and 580,000. And that is nearly doubling for 3 years in a row. Is that purely down to what you've just been describing?
I think, you know, the transition, I suppose, is those are the first sort of years we've really been operating out of this place 100%. You know, and fortunately, when you get some good results, you know, a few other people notice you and you get sent some better horses. And I think we've got a lot more confident in ourselves, and actually to go out and, you know, go and buy a couple more horses, and you know, people are more willing to invest into those. You know, we run a lot of syndicates in-house here. A lot of our horses are owned, you know, by groups of people that we've put together, or, you know, they don't necessarily always know each other beforehand, and, you know, hopefully they get to know each other on the way, and, you know, they become good friends, and, you know, they have some good days together. And yeah, it's a great experience owning horses. And I think also with the information that we're sort of passing on in terms of, you know, some of that science and data, it's quite nice to share that. Because not, you know, especially people who maybe didn't grow up around horses or don't really come in contact day to day with horses, actually, you know, a trainer saying some of the sort of traditional things that we might say about a horse doesn't actually mean very much to them. But actually, if you can show them a graph or a picture or, you know, an x-ray and a bit of data, it sort of brings it a bit more alive to them. You know, me talking over a video of a horse going up a gallop saying it's going very well probably doesn't mean a lot to most people, because they don't have that finely tuned eye, that, you know, that sort of horseman's eye or horsewoman's eye that's looking at the horses every day to understand the difference. But actually, a set of numbers is, most people can understand that 40 miles an hour is quicker than 38.
Now, you've mentioned previously, I think you said, Claire, that you're form students. So, I mean, I'm assuming you watch a lot of racing on the telly or whatever, and sort of, have you got time to sort of go into it like that?
I think particularly around sale season, obviously when you're entered in a race, you really get to know the form of that kind of group of horses that you're going to keep running against all summer. Building up to the sales, we get our heads down and we work. Yeah, we get through a lot of races, a lot of analysis. Yeah. Just going back to the success over the last 3 years, as Dan said, it's confidence, but it's multifactorial. It's having this great facility. It's having a really established team where they all really trust and respect each other and always pushing individually to be the best that they can. Mm-hmm. It's talent spotting. You know, it's using all this data as well that we're now using a lot more and putting it together as a puzzle and saying, actually, this horse is better suited to this particular track, or this horse is better suited to this style of racing. And by being that more precise and informed, we're just getting a lot more accurate in our results, well, better in our results because of it. You're not wasting runs while you're trying to figure something out.
When you've got it all figured out and everything lines up, do you ring your bookmaker? Do you?
I don't bet, but I do know when Astro King was going for the Cambridgeshire, I think the jockey's agent was. Yeah, it was a weird experience, really, because, yeah, to be going into a big race like that and inwardly feeling pretty confident, and, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a trainer, you always get a percentage anyway, so in some ways that's the reward. But it's the, yeah, there's times where you think, well, that horse shouldn't be 20-1 or 25-1 or whatever it is, but I think backing a 5-2 shot into 6-4 probably isn't that exciting. I don't know, for me, you know, but, you know, we're punting all the time, because every year we go and buy. We probably go and spend £200,000 of money we don't have, and then have to sell these horses on to people on the basis that we believe they can win races and they can perform on the track, and, you know, that hopefully people get a lot of enjoyment from them, and that satisfaction of getting it right for people and the enjoyment that people get out of having a winner. It's funny, you start training, and it's probably not something we thought about much, is, you know, it was about how do you train winners, but actually the satisfaction that owners get when they own a winner, that's sort of reflected, how do you put it, like seeing them enjoy it so much and what it means to them is so rewarding. And I think all of that side to it is, you know, it's sort of like you're satisfied. For me anyway, it's not a financial thing. It's the reward of actually seeing someone be so happy and, you know, a job well done. You know, because training horses is, it looks very easy. You're just trying to get one to go faster from A to A to B. It's never quite so straightforward in practice. So when it all goes right, I think you have to enjoy it. And, you know, I think it's so important you do enjoy it when they win.
Okay, now hopefully I've left the best question till last. You talked about all the science. How much, because you read Martin Pipe's book years ago. He was ahead of everybody else with his, you know, the stuff he was doing. Everybody's caught up with him. How much further can the science go? I mean, are you talking inches just to win those big handicaps, you know, doing all the things you do, or can you, are the horses better now, or are they just better understood and better trained and better fed?
I think there's so much to this question. I think the first thing I'd say about scientific progress is never like that. And, you know, it sort of goes in, so, and I think always the most dangerous thing is when you think there is nothing more to learn, it's probably just when something massive is about to change around the corner. So I think you've always got to be thinking, you can improve and do things better. Otherwise, what's the point? If you think you've cracked it, you're in trouble.
What do you think, Claire?
I think the very top people in this industry are probably doing a lot of what we're doing anyway, but we'll be keeping it behind closed doors. In terms of us as a yard trying to compete against all the big people, it helps give us an edge, but to keep pushing, because ultimately, yeah, it's talent spotting, it's getting the better quality horses in so that we can showcase how good our team is and what they can achieve. The breed overall, gosh, I mean, Frankel is like one of the best that you've seen, you know, and it's a pleasure to be in an industry like this where when you get the real stars, like to celebrate them and to see their offspring starting to race on the track. And yeah. Will the breed keep on improving? Yeah, I think it will. I mean, records aren't necessarily getting broken every day, but there's just so much satisfaction to even just competing against the age group you're against or the class that you're in.
I mean, I think there's a lot of track records that do get broken, but actually, you know, a lot of them aren't changing because we don't race on ground as quick as it used to be, for example. But I think there's some quite interesting research, I'm trying to think where it was from, where basically they said, yeah, okay, the track records maybe aren't shifting much, but the sort of middle of the road races are getting quicker and quicker. So that's probably suggesting that overall the breed is improving, or maybe the breed's not improving, maybe we're getting better at realising its potential. It's probably a bit of both. You know, breeders are getting cleverer about thinking about how they breed and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, there's people who are very innovative in those areas and, you know, looking at genetics on a massive scale and looking at all of that kind of things and understanding, you know, AI is going to change how data's handled. And you can't tell me that someone isn't working somewhere on a model that's going to, you know, take steps forward in terms of breeding horses and equally training horses and understanding placing horses. There's so many factors to producing a horse to be a champion that, you know, and they all have to line up right, that every little step that you can do to put those odds slightly more in your favour is critical. And same as when you're making a bet.
Okay, just a final question. My mole obviously told me quite a few secrets about the training, which we've talked about. How much have I missed that you've kept up your sleeves?
Can't give away all the secret sauce.
And I don't blame you either. Claire and Dan Kubler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Claire and Dan, this is further to the main interview, which we try and keep the shelf life long. This one is talking about the forthcoming season. Now, I'm sure you're very excited about it already, and the people would be keen to know if there's any from your yard that they should be keeping an eye on.
Well, he's already actually run. He won a novice the other day at Southwell, one of these valuable Sunday evening novices. A horse called Bravo Zulu. He won a Kempton Maiden last year, and then he won under his penalty. And he's a horse on our data that looks like he could be, pretty smart. He starts the season off of 84. The plan is he'll go for a mile handicap at the Craven meeting. I think that's what we're thinking at the moment. And we'll go from there. And he could develop into a sort of, I think eventually he'll be a 10 furlong horse. It's whether we do, we lay him probably at things like the Britannia at Royal Ascot, that sort of a horse. Or maybe there is the 10 furlong handicap now, which I forget what it's called, the copper horse handicap, I think it's called. But he's definitely a horse who's on the right side of the handicap as he starts the season anyway.
I think probably go with Raymunda. She's a filly actually with an American pedigree. She won a novice at Haydock last year really nicely. Very lightly raced, lovely, beautiful big filly. When we talk about stride data, I think her stride length is one of the longest we've ever recorded at home. And we had someone come and do some heart scans and look at some kind of AI in terms of biomechanics, but he commented on her heart scan that it was huge. I'm really intrigued by her this year, and hopefully she'll be running middle of next month at Kempton or Southwell on the 10th or the 12th. And go from there and see how far she can progress this year.
And you mentioned syndicates. Have you got horses available for shares and people contact you to get involved?
Yeah. We've got, what have we got at the moment? We've got a couple of two-year-olds, a horse we bought at Tassels Island. Actually, both of them we bought at Tassels Island. We bought two colts from that sale last year. They both won. One of them was Bravo Zulu. And the other one was a horse called Crimson Spirit, who won a valuable novice at Epsom. So they both already have won pretty much what they cost in prize money. So we've got a little colt who's bred to be very quick by a stallion called Invincible Army. He's called Echo of Glory. So we're doing 5 and 10% shares in him. He should be a lot of fun. And then we've got a really sort of classy filly, slightly different, more of a middle distance type. The Dam got black type. She was placed in a couple of the Oaks trials. She won as a two-year-old and then kind of progressed as a three-year-old, and I think this filly would be in the same. She's by a stallion called Study of Man, who had his first runners last year and had a Group 2 winner from his first crop. Deep Impact is the sire of him, so it's that sort of Japanese line that's doing so well. There's not much of that line in Europe, so quite interesting to see how he goes as a stallion, because again, he was a French Derby winner, so you'd expect his horses to improve as three-year-old.